local news and views and the greatest variety of music, this is Southern FM 88.3.
This is the Space Show with Andrew Rennie and Jay. Now, 50 years ago today, the first Australian satellite was put into orbit. Indeed, 50 years and 3 hours ago. Welcome to part two of three Space Show specials celebrating this event. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. Joining me is Jay, who has lots of questions.
I was wondering, last time we finished with some problems on the launching pad, wasn't it?
Yes, we're going to come to those in a moment.
Oh, right.
Okay, but I think Jay's wondering why the satellite is so significant.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you come from which country?
From Russia.
Okay, and now we're trying to teach you the new Australian Australian space history.
Okay.
Good one. Okay, well, why is it significant? Because this satellite was built in Australia. Significant because this satellite was launched from Australia. And that satellite was RESAT-1, R-E-S-A-T. And it's sort of an acronym for the Weapons Research Establishment Satellite. The launch site was Woomera in South Australia. Now, here is how the satellite was described in 1967 by the research establishment.
Experiments carried in the satellite were designed to extend the range of data obtained previously from research programs in which sounding rockets were used to probe the upper atmosphere. The satellite experiments were designed to use ionization chambers and detectors to measure solar radiation in X-ray and ultraviolet wavebands. Such information contributes to knowledge of solar-terrestrial relationships and, in particular, the way in which solar radiations influence the composition and structure of the upper atmosphere. An energy dissipator, consisting of a closed loop of aluminium tubing filled with silicone oil, was fitted to change the axis of satellite spin quickly so that the sideways and forward-facing experiments would be exposed to the sun as the satellite spun. A number of precautions were taken to protect the cone and its contents from extremes of heat and cold. As a protection against aerodynamic heating during launch, 1/8-inch sheet cork painted black was fixed to the surface of the cone where protrusions occurred. The remaining surface was also painted black so that a suitable balance would be achieved in orbit between heat absorption and emission. Internally, the cone was painted white to promote uniformity of temperature, and a shroud of aluminium foil and glass cloth was placed over the third stage motor to shield the interior of the cone and instrumentation from its heat. To further simulate space conditions, the flight cone was subjected to hot and cold soak in a vacuum chamber. Here, under atmospheric pressure of 5 millimeters of mercury, the temperature was varied between minus 15 and 50 degrees centigrade in a 7-hour cycle for a number of days. Final preparation involved the checking of weight and moments of inertia about the various axes. These are fundamental properties which determine the orbit and attitude of satellite. The total mass placed in orbit was 186 pounds. The satellite cone was now complete. Before sending it to the firing range at Woomera, it was taken to Canberra to the Auroral Valley Tracking Station. Here, the cone was placed in a screened room and careful checks were made which demonstrated its compatibility with the ground receiving equipment. The Auroral Valley Station is one of the US global network of such stations that would track the satellite when in orbit.
In last week's program, as Jay has just said, we began to describe how a very expensive paint had been imported from the United States. American advice had been that this was necessary to keep the temperatures inside the satellite at a level to prevent the electronics and instruments from overheating in the baking heat of the sun. In a 48-hour stint, 15 quick-drying coats of this expensive paint were applied. The two painters claimed they sustained themselves by occasional visits to the pub. Only much later did it come to light that the paint of the wrong specification had been shipped from America. Its properties were no different from those of any household white enamel.
Wait, so did they stop the launch?
Well, No, and there's a good reason for that. The launch wasn't going to be done by the Australians. There was a launch crew from TRW, which had been launching the Sparta rockets, and they had to go home. So they said to the Aussies, look, mate, you know, we're going home. If you don't launch this thing, that's tough bickies. So they didn't stop the launch. So, as I said, by this time it was too late to do anything about it. So ReSat flew with the wrong paint.
Wow.
And despite this, everything in the heat regulation system worked perfectly.
And they say Russians are crazy.
Yeah. So the internal temperatures were within a couple of degrees of the predicted figure for the whole of the flight.
Speaking of Russians, Sputnik was the battery powered. What about ReSat?
Well, although it would have been ideal to have ReSat powered by solar cells, the satellite was, like Sputnik 1, battery powered. This was because it was not possible to design an array of solar cells in the brief time before launch. Remember, they only had 11 months to design and build this thing and get it launched. So solar cells would, of course, have allowed the satellite to operate and collect experimental data indefinitely until ReSat re-entered the atmosphere and burnt up. Instead, the batteries would last only a few days. Now, this was long enough to gather basic data, but not to do any grand or long-term science.
Well, that's still better than Sputnik did. I mean, it was just producing a broadcasted a signal that it was pretty much all it done. Didn't send any scientific data back. But it was also built within a few months. How long did it actually take to make ReSat?
Well, 11 months. So after 11 months of preparations, the satellite was mounted on the Redstone rocket. In 1967, November the 28th, the countdown started at 8:19 a.m. South Australian time. During the morning, all proceeded smoothly. And then, just as 30 seconds from zero, a heater cooler unit failed to eject from the side of the Redstone, and this caused an automatic stop.
Vapor or smoke from the house call aboard.
10 minutes. All point gone one. There's firing at the border. All posts remain on standby until a further announcement. All posts cease recording.
Well, there we are. Unfortunately, the rocket has not left the launching pad. The test has been aborted. That is, it has been cancelled for the moment. Now, Fred Guy, what does that mean at this stage?
Well, it means at the moment they were going to the procedure for disarming the vehicle and then endeavouring to find out what was the problem.
What is the significance of this one-hour window, which is the only time during which the rocket could be launched?
Well, because of the geometry and the dynamics of the satellite, which has an experiment which is designed to point at the sun, and this is achieved by spinning the rocket. The rocket must be spun in the right plane. And to get this right plane, you must launch when the sun is in a certain position.
And I recorded that from Radio Australia, off shortwave radio, and the interference there was caused by local televisions. It's funny, the neighbours didn't appreciate what was happening, and they didn't give it a rat's whatever it is, that I was trying to record from shortwave radio, an important historic event. Well, next day, Wednesday, November the 29th, the six-hour countdown proceeded faultlessly. At 2:19 p.m., right on schedule, the 21-metre-tall Redstone climbed into a hot blue South Australian sky. In the days before the launch, the Australians had painted over the camouflage green of the Redstone with white paint. Over that, they had painted a black kangaroo and a ReSat emblem. The launch had come in just in time, because like today, as the afternoon wore on, the temperatures in Woolma rose, a howling northwesterly wind rose, and a dust storm made things very unpleasant. The launch vehicle preparation team, which had been supplied by Thomson Ramo Wooldridge Systems of the United States, quickly retired to the air-conditioned comfort of nearby buildings.
So, America launches their rockets over oceans, so the early stages drop into that. Russia launches over Siberia. How do Aussies make sure the rockets wouldn't hit any towns?
Well, that was the aiming the rocket in the right direction to make sure that, as I said, it wouldn't hit any towns or even Papua New Guinea. So that's one of the reasons, in fact, that Woomera is being used, because it's an overland rocket range with hardly anyone living there.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go now to another feature from the Weapons Research Establishment about the final checks and the liftoff of the rocket.
With the arrival of the Resat Kern from Canberra, final checks and assembly were begun. The Kern was checked out and explosive components were fitted. The sensors received a final check using a hydrogen light source rich in ultraviolet. The space between was flushed with nitrogen gas to prevent oxygen absorption. The radar transponder received a final check. Finally, the covers were fitted, the nose cone was screwed down, and Resat was ready. It was then taken to the launching area for mating to the rocket. Here, with great care, to the relief of some and the confusion of the skeptics, it mated up perfectly, and the whole assembly was ready for launching. Erection was completed, the umbilical cord was attached. Through this cord, monitoring functions were maintained and power was supplied to ignite the rocket engines. In the nearby control van, missile functions were checked. When all was well, the countdown began. The optical tracker had a hazy view of the launcher scene due to the high ground temperature. As the countdown proceeds, the heater cooler drop tank is shed. Light up. Lift off. Passes through an atmospheric layer of high humidity. The line of fire is 6 degrees east of north. The tracking camera loses the missile, finds it again. The first stage is all burnt. It separates and falls away into the Simpson Desert. The second stage was destined to fall into the Gulf of Carpentaria to the north of Australia, but heating on re-entry may have burnt it up. Its fall was not observed. Final injection into orbit occurred at latitude 27 degrees, 30 minutes south.
So how did they even track it?
Well, that's the interesting thing. They put up tracking stations along the route across northern Australia, and including one at Gove on the Gulf of Carpentaria.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a particular invention that was made by Australia to track not just Resat, but earlier rockets back in the, as we'll hear shortly, back in the ALDO days, the European Launcher Development days.
Some sort of radar?
Yeah, a radar, but also a computer system,
mm-hmm.
a special one. So way back in 1958, and that was just months after Sputnik 1 was launched, approval was granted for the Weapons Research Establishment in Salisbury to develop a computerized system to predict the trajectories and impact points of rockets launched from Woomera. This digital impact predictor was the most complicated and demanding piece of ranged instrumentation ever developed by the Weapons Research Establishment. Now, not only did it have to solve the complex ballistic equations 10 times a second and make the results available instantly, even while the rocket was speeding along its trajectory, it also had to trigger the destruction of the rocket if it veered off course without consulting the operators.
Hmm.
Now, that was quite a remarkable achievement back in those days. I mean, today you'd say, oh, gee, my iPhone can do better than that. Well, this computer had 13,000 germanium transistors and 8,000 diodes individually wired and was installed in Woomera in 1963. So this digital impact predictor was used in the Sparta tests and for the Resat launch, but it was also used in the Europa tests. And, for example, here is how the digital impact predictor was described by Peter Pockley during the ABC Radio's live commentary of the launch of the Europa 1F4 rocket on 1966, May the 24th.
But it's being tracked now by the radar system. The optical tracking system's downrange are also feeding that information back to the computers, but by now their major usefulness has gone.
I have completely lost Europa 1 in my binoculars now through the thin source cloud cover, but we can hear the roar of it as it streams away to the north. The voices you can hear coming back are those of the plotting table operators who are getting the information fed through the digital impact predictor, which takes the data from the radar systems and gives the exact point at which Europa 1 is, its trajectory, its velocity, and what is the most remarkable part about this computer is that it is able to tell exactly where Europa 1 would land if the motors cut out at any one stage. It's a sort of pear-shaped safety area stretching out to the north across the Simpson Desert from Woomera, and the pins of the plotting tables need to remain within that pear-shaped safety area.
And, Jay, you asked about how did they, you know, avoid the various towns and things heading north, but they also had to avoid Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, fair enough, actually.
Yeah, heading north, you don't want to sort of land in Papua New Guinea. So to cover the special characteristics of the RESAT flight, the digital impact predictor was fed with a program written to protect Papua New Guinea from accidental impact. Now, had the Redstone rocket veered off course, the digital impact predictor would have commanded a breakup system called REBUS, REBUS. So, and REBUS would have destroyed the vehicle. The radio command to destroy the Redstone second stage would have been sent from Woomera to a REBUS transmitter in Udnadatta, then radioed up to the rocket. Udnadatta, of course, is a famous sort of pub-only town in the middle of Australia. Now, fortunately, the second stage showed no sign of going astray, so REBUS did not have to perform. It's one of those cases where you make a piece of equipment, you hope it's going to work if it's needed, but you hope it's not going to be needed, like insurance.
Yeah, of course.
And our confidence that the rocket was on course for orbit was provided by precision radars called FPS-16. Now, one of these was located at Woomera's Red Lake. Another was 170 kilometres downrange, downrange past Mount Eba. Now, to aid the FPS-16 radars, the RESAT satellite had a C-band transponder beacon. Now, this system operated right through to orbital insertion. The early ascent of the Redstone was watched by observers using sky screens and optical trackers. Now, we're going to hear more about RESAT after the station announcement.
Hi, this is Mark Holden, and you're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
But, yeah, with the hiccup at the start with the Redstone rocket, how did it go during the actual flight?
Well, the Redstone rocket was normally quite a reliable one, which is why it was used in the Mercury program to launch several astronauts, Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom, for example. Mm-hmm. So the Redstone motor thrust was approximately 333 kilonewtons, and it burnt for 122 seconds. Now, after burnout, the Redstone booster and the co-joined second and third stages and satellite coasted on up to an altitude of 170 kilometres. Now, at that point, the second stage ignited and propelled the vehicle northwards. Now, we have an interview at the moment from Richard Tonkin. I had a chat with him a few weeks ago. He was a member of the Australis Oscar 5 team, and he went to Woomera to witness the RESAT 1 launch and also took the chance to go into the Woomera Heritage Museum, which is open to the public. And, of course, we had a chat about his satellite, which was the first built but second launched Australian satellite. Richard Tonkin. Welcome to the Space Show, Richard.
Thanks, Andrew. It's nice to be here.
Now, I understand you went to the launch of ReSat.
Yes, that does age me a bit because it was 50 years ago in November, and I was invited by WRE, or at least the Australis Amateur Radio Satellite Group were invited by WRE to send a representative over for the launch.
So how did you get over there, Richard?
Oh, well, I flew over by commercial flight to Adelaide, and then I joined the media plane, the press plane, which was an Air Force DC-3 that took off from, must have been an Air Force base outside Adelaide, and flew to Woomera. And, of course, it was late spring, almost summer, and the desert was heating up and the flight was particularly bumpy. The man next to me went on to become the editor of The Age, and he got greener and greener as the flight went on. And he said, "I don't feel very well." And I said, "You don't look very well." And I said, "Yeah, hold on, we're going to land fairly soon. You'll feel a lot better after we land." So we landed, and we just landed, and he headed for the sick bag. He reached for the sick bag, and that was that. Anyway, we were then bussed out to the launch site, and of course the ReSat rocket was a U.S. Army Redstone with a couple of solid fuel stages on top. And the launch pad was very simple, just a concrete slab and a base that it sat on. And the blockhouse was a U.S. Army trailer. I reckon it was only a couple of hundred metres away, covered in sandbags. So we were probably kept about, I don't know, 1 or 2 kilometres away. I don't remember exactly how far. So the countdown went down to zero, and nothing happened. And we sat there and sat there for about a minute. And then they said, "Sorry, it's all off, didn't work, go back to Adelaide, come back tomorrow," which we did, back on the DC-3, back on the bumpy flight back to Adelaide. I made sure I wasn't sitting next to the future editor of The Age. Repeat next morning, got on the plane, went back, and went out to the launch site, and the countdown went down to zero, and the Redstone lit up, LOX and kerosene, liquid oxygen and kerosene engine, liquid fuel engine, and took off into a nice clear blue sky. And we were able to follow it for tens of thousands of feet. And I don't remember seeing the burnout or the second stage ignition, but it was certainly on its way. And we were being informed about what was happening. Everything was working fine. And the satellite was put into orbit. And they reported that the orbit was pretty much as planned. It was a pretty low Earth orbit. In fact, it only stayed up for about 43 or 45 days, transmitted for a week or two weeks, and it re-entered the atmosphere about 5 or 6 weeks after the launch. But it was a great thing to see Australia's first satellite launching.
Were you disappointed because you had actually built the first satellite?
Yes. Well, Australis, of course, was the first Australian satellite. It just wasn't launched first. We took it to the States in June 67 while ReSat was still being built, and we were ready to launch. We expected to get a launch in about September or October, which would have meant we would have beaten ReSat into orbit. But something went wrong at the other end with the administration of the whole thing, and they told us that the US Air Force had classified their military satellite launches, which it was going on, and we didn't get a launch. There is a conspiracy theory that says that the Australian government told the American government to make sure we didn't get launched first. But that's just a conspiracy theory. It's a nice theory, but it's, you know, who knows.
And that was a pre-internet age conspiracy theory.
Oh, yes. Well, we assumed that the Australian embassy in Canberra was advised about this, and they were told to have a word to the Defence Department to make sure that we didn't go off before ReSat. I have absolutely no evidence whatsoever to back that up, but I like the story.
And how long after the launch was it before you knew it had made it into orbit?
ReSat?
ResSat.
Quite quickly. I mean, the telemetry down the up the range indicated that the stages had all fired as planned, and they told us, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes after the launch that it was in orbit. Yeah. Unlike because the early days of Sputnik and so on, when you had to wait till it came back over the launch site an hour and a half later, no, they had enough telemetry up the range to know it was safely in orbit.
What else can you say about it?
Oh, well, it was interesting in that that was the last Redstone that was ever launched, and it was a spare rocket from a missile reentry test that the US Army was doing at Woomera. The Army offered to the Australian government more Redstones because they were sitting in the Redstone arsenal in Huntsville in Alabama, just in storage. And if we wanted to launch more satellites, they'd send them over. But the Australian government said, no, we aren't into space, and there were no more Redstones.
And what was your thought about that at the time?
Oh, well, of course, I didn't know that there weren't going to be any more Redstones, but we suspected, having regard to the previous governments of each political persuasion's attitude towards space, that it was probably going to be an orphan, and of course it was.
And why were the Redstones here in the first place?
The Army sent 10 or 11 over with these two upper stages calls, and the system, the mission was called Sparta, and they were doing missile nose cone re-entry tests. They'd send the Redstone and the first stage up to out of the atmosphere, and then they'd turn the third stage around, drive it back through the atmosphere with the nose cone, and measure the results as it came down.
And why couldn't the Americans do that in America?
Oh, well, they wanted to. I'm not really sure whether they actually recovered any of the nose cones or not. They certainly would have re-entered the atmosphere, probably crashed to the desert, and they dug them out. There was really no range in America where they could do it. White Sands wasn't really big enough to be able to do it. And of course, the other launch sites at Cape Canaveral and Vandenberg in California were over the water, and they wouldn't be able to get them back.
Now, Dick Smith, years later, went and recovered part of the Redstone and brought it back to Woomera. Have you seen it there?
I did. I saw it in September. I was over in Adelaide for the International Astronautical Congress, and it is there sitting in the rocket park in the Woomera village. It's got a cage around it so people can't get into it and touch it. What it needs is a building put around it because it's a piece of our space history, and it really should be properly protected. And I like the Saturn V is at Cape Canaveral. It would be a fairly simple matter to build even a shed over it to protect it. Of course, the weather up there is fairly benign, but eventually it'll just start to rot away.
Well, when I was last up in Woomera, you could actually go up and touch it.
No, the cage is over it now and you can't touch it now. Otherwise, I would have scraped a flake of paint off it as a souvenir.
And can the public go and see it?
Oh, yes, it's out in what they call the Rocket Park at Woomera, just near the there's quite a nice museum that they've built up there now, which has got a history of Woomera and what's gone off from there and what's been developed there. So you can go right up to it, but as I say, it's got this cage over it. It really needs a museum built around it.
And ResSat itself, last time I was in Woomera, there was a model of it on display.
Oh, yes, there is. There's quite a lot in the museum about ResSat, and it's well worth visiting. Yeah. And you can get access up to the base. I'm not sure. Well, we went up there on a direct flight from Adelaide. It was a charter flight, but I believe you can get up there and get access to the area. And the museum's well worth seeing. Yes, it's very well done. Yeah.
Yes, it's just a short detour from Pimba. Off the Stuart Highway to get into the Woomera Heritage Museum.
Yeah, well, you drove, I flew.
Okay, actually, I've flown there as well, but are there any other models of ResSat on display anywhere in Australia that you're aware of?
No, I'm not sure if there's one at the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney. There may be one up there, but I haven't seen another one, no.
And what about your satellite? Is there anything on display here in Australia?
No, unfortunately, well, the one we flew was the one we built, and there was no backup. There is a engineering model in the stores at the Science Works Museum in Melbourne, and if you are ever in Melbourne and you want to do a tour of the stores, you can ask that it be brought out, and you can go down to the stores and they'll show it to you. We're certainly hoping that when the 20th anniversary The 50th anniversary of, which was only the 20th, of Australis comes up in 2020, that ScienceWorks will put it on display in the main part of the museum. Of course, the Australis satellite had the last laugh on reset. Reset was in orbit for about 5 or 6 weeks before it re-entered. The last we heard from NORAD in America, the North American Air Defence Command, which tracks everything, was that it had an estimated life of 100,000 years.
Well, you sure beat reset then.
We did indeed, yes.
Well, thanks for joining us on the Space Show, Richard.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Andrew.
And I was talking there with Richard Tonkin, a member of the Australis Oscar 5 team. And he lives right here in Melbourne, and they built that at Melbourne University. But today, we're looking at Reset 1.
So you mentioned that the Stage 1 took it to, like, 190 kilometres, 160. And so what was its ultimate highest altitude?
Okay, well, Reset's orbit ranged from a perigee, or low point, of 169 kilometres, and an apogee, or high point, of 1,245 kilometres. So it's sometimes described as an egg-shaped orbit, although officially it's an elliptical orbit.
Egg-shape would not do it justice.
Sorry?
Egg shape wouldn't do that shape justice.
No. So it's mathematically, it's an elliptical orbit.
Yeah.
Okay, so RESAT relayed data from the scientific experiments for 73 orbits. And that was about 5 days. And by this time, the battery power was too low to operate the instruments. However, enough energy remained in the batteries to sustain transmission for another 5 days. The silent satellite then continued in its rapidly decaying orbit until 1968, January the 10th. It burnt up in the atmosphere over the Atlantic Ocean somewhere between Iceland and Ireland, travelling at 28,000 kilometres per hour.
Okay, so being spherical and not having any scientific instruments, Sputnik didn't need to be stabilized. It could spin for as much as it wanted. What about reset?
Well, it had to be stabilized to achieve the aims of most satellites. In fact, most satellites do need to be stabilized, and that just means pointed in a particular direction, say, up at the Earth or up at the sky or whatever. Now, for example, Earth observation satellites need to point their cameras down towards the ground.
Naturally.
Communication satellites need to point their antennae at particular places on the Earth. Well, reset was no different. It was necessary to control the satellite's attitude in some way so that sensors could be positioned to view the sun. The attitude control method chosen was simply to use the spin imparted by the spin-stabilized second and third rocket stages. The spinning satellite kept pointing at the same direction. Now, each solar sensor was positioned so that it could view the sun once every revolution of the satellite. However, the initial spin axis was not in the desired direction, so rotational kinetic energy had to be dissipated to reach the stable spin condition. And this was achieved by using a fluid loop energy dissipator. This consisted basically of a closed tube filled with fluid. The spin energy went into stirring the fluid, then to heat energy via the action of viscosity. Careful placement of the angle of the fluid loop ensured that one direction of spin was not affected by the energy loss. By the way, the fluid used was MS200 silicone. The viscosity or stickiness of the silicone changed with temperature, and this had to be allowed for in the design calculations.
So how was it decided which experiments would be carried out by RESET?
Well, in a number of ways, but let me just first explain about the system and how it worked.
Didn't you just do that?
In flight, the required attitude change took place within the first orbit. This was faster than predicted, and that mystified the engineers. Now, several reasons were proposed for this rapid damping, but nothing definitive was concluded. In any case, the fluid loop energy dissipator was found to be a simple and effective means of making a satellite reach its stable spin axis, and my understanding is that it was used on some other satellites, but not Australian satellites, because we didn't have any more after that.
Okay, so again, how was it decided which experiments would be carried out by RESAT?
Well, there were several factors that determined what experiments would be carried by RESAT. Jay, one of the early decisions was to send RESAT north into a polar orbit. Now, this was the same path, slightly east of due north, which had been used by the fourth flight of the European Launcher Development Organization the previous May, and we heard a little bit about that flight earlier in the show. Now, this path would take the satellite east of Darwin. The first rocket stage would impact in the Northern Territory near Queensland border, and the second stage would impact in the Gulf of Carpentaria east of Gove. So another factor was the decision that the instruments aboard RESAT should be very similar to those already being used in Woomera's sounding rocket program. These included packages launched for John Carver's group at Adelaide University. That's Professor John Carver. Whereas a sounding rocket can measure the upper atmosphere for only a few minutes over a limited time, a satellite can measure around the globe for days, months, or even decades. And that's because a sounding rocket rises to a few hundred kilometres before falling back to Earth some minutes later. Now, we'll talk more about the instrumentation carried on RESAT and have some more of the sounds from it in next week's Space Show. But right now, we've got to hand over to Purple Haze, Mark Kopolov, with Russell Morris and Jack Jones and others. I'm Andrew Rennie. Thanks for Jay.